that everyone is here and ready to present. Before we get started, I do want to introduce the panel to you. To my left is Judge Ruben Gonzalez, who is sitting by assignment.
Good morning.
To my right is Justice Elizabeth Kerr, and I'm Bonnie Sutter. I'm the Chief of the Court. Before we begin argument, I'll ask the clerk to please call the case.
The court will now call number 02-25-275-CB, Modern Builders, LLC versus the City of Fort Worth. May it please the court, Mr. Patrick Sutton will argue for appellant. Mr. Joe Greenhill will argue for appellee.
Thank you. Mr. Sutton?
May it please the court. I take my theme this morning from the rocker songwriter Matthew Sweet, who has a song called Knowing People, in which he sings, I don't like knowing people, and I don't like people knowing about me. One can imagine this doesn't go over too well in Beijing, where monitoring and surveilling every citizen is the official policy of the government. But increasingly what we're seeing, because of the issue of short-term rentals, is local governments seeking to monitor, surveil, interrogate, and control the lives of ordinary people going to and from private homes. We can't say that we weren't warned. In 2019, the Zatari court in Austin dropped a footnote warning exactly of monitoring and surveillance of people in their homes. In 2021, the U.S. Supreme Court decides Cedar Point Nursery versus Hasid, after the state of California had said private landowners must allow labor organizers to come onto their land. The U.S. Supreme Court started to distance itself from the 1930s case Caroline Products, which was the case that inaugurates the rational basis test. And so in a property rights case, we have the U.S. Supreme Court saying, no, state of California, the right to exclude people from your property is a fundamental right. This is per se unconstitutional.
So are you asking us to not apply the rational basis test at all?
The rational basis test is one part of the Patel test, which applies in Texas. And so it is open to you to apply that test, but the city also has to satisfy the second prong of that test, which does not apply at the federal level. And of course, the second prong asks you to balance the burden imposed on a right, the oppressiveness versus the oppressiveness of a city's regulation. And that will, as I will get to, help us out of the impasse of the Draper case, which was decided around the same time as Grapevine. The issue, then, in this case, squarely presented, is whether the government can dictate how long people stay in private homes, and as a necessary and inescapable corollary, enforce that law or ordinance by monitoring and surveilling citizens to find out who they are and where they're from and why they're staying. And so as the panel can probably tell, my focus today is almost solely on the liberty interest presented by this case. First, I'm going to provide a hypothetical and then some examples from my practice over the last 15 years, which I think help the court see what's at stake. I'll then talk about how the liberty interest arises, which I think is interesting because it goes to the very deepest aspects of American and Texas jurisprudence. Finally, I'll talk about the consequences of allowing cities to monitor and surveil citizens to determine nothing more than how long they're staying in a house. Okay, first, let's talk about hypotheticals and an example. Suppose that you live in Fort Worth, you decide on a Monday to start monitoring a house that's across the street from you. And what you see is a family roll up in a car, they take their bags, they get out, they stay until Friday. they take their bag, they roll their bags, and maybe during the week you saw them sunning themselves on the lawn or swimming in the pool, and on Friday they leave. Saturday morning, a couple of airline pilots, a man and a woman come in, bring their bags in. They stay for 3 days. Then they, too, get their bags and they leave. You never saw them in the meantime. You have no idea who they are, why they were there, or what they were doing. What do we know about these people? Absolutely nothing, except that they did not stay in that house for 30 days. We don't know whether they own it, whether they partly own it. We don't know whether they rented it. We don't even know whether they're friends of the owners who were staying as guests.
Let me just interrupt you and ask. I mean, you know, obviously you're pushing the liberty interest. I get that. But there seem to be some competing interests involved as well. And what, you know, the city takes the position, as I understand it, that single-family zoning exists for a reason, and that is to promote a neighborhood character where people do know their neighbors and that sort of thing. So do the people watching the comings and goings across the street not have any sort of interest in knowing who their neighbors are?
Well, I guess I get back to my theme. I don't like knowing people, and I don't like people knowing about me. I would say the neighbor's interest in knowing who comes and goes from someone else's land is minimal, and I think the government's interest in that is also minimal.
So are there any sorts of STR-specific ordinances that you think would be valid?
Yes. So I have two answers to that. First, on equal protection grounds, I think it's fair to say anything that would apply to leasing for more than 30 days can also apply to leasing for 30 days. Where I live, I have to get a license to rent out a small accessory dwelling, and I have to pay a fee, and I actually have to have an inspection of the property. And it doesn't matter how long I rent it for, I must go through these hoops. And I'm not supposed to rent before I get a license, but if I do, the ticket that I get is for renting without a license. And then I pay the ticket and I get my license. I haven't lost the right to lease. That's the first part. The second part is, in the case of short-term rentals, as a practical matter, over the years, we have not challenged a number of regulations which I personally, as an attorney, think go somewhat too far, but are still objective requirements. So let me tell you about the cases that have gone much further and that we now have pending around the state. In Valenti, you have a permit process which is open-ended and doesn't really have standards. And so you run into the span problem. And you may recall that in Span in 1921, there were two issues. But one of them was that a local official had unbridled discretion to deny someone the ability to, say, operate a store in a residential area. Unbridled discretion, some would say, is an independent claim under the Texas Constitution. In the City of Dickinson case, which is now under submission in the First Court of Appeals, the City of Dickinson has an ordinance which says for a short-term rental, to rent for short terms, you have to get a permit. And here are the factors we consider, and it lists two or three factors. And then it says, and any other factor. It is the same in the as the Valenti ordinance in the sense that there really are no standards. It becomes entirely subjective whether the government gives you a permit. So, Justice Kerr, the answer to your question is, a few objective requirements that people are accustomed to when they want to do some sort of activity in a city are things that we have not so far challenged because they impose, under the second prong of Patel, a minimal burden on the right, number one. And number two, they're objective, a fee, an inspection, a notification provision. I'll move on. I hope I've answered your question. So we talked about the hypothetical. And then I want to go back now to give you some examples over the years of what I've encountered and how the liberty interest arises in my cases. The first appeal I ever argued in a short-term rental case, excuse me. Was the Skyby case. 10 years ago. That's SGABAY. And almost immediately, a senior member of that panel described how he and his family use and enjoy short-term rentals. And we prevailed in that case. That was a deed restriction case. We get to 2 years ago in the Anding case, which is a reported federal district court case out of Austin. The Andings had been denied the ability to get a license, and a senior federal judge who travels among different districts then spent 10 minutes describing for the parties at summary judgment how he relies on short-term rentals as he travels from district to district to decide cases. We prevailed in that case on retroactivity grounds.
But the City of Austin ordinance was a lot different from the one that Fort Worth has adopted, wasn't it?
I don't think so. So what they were doing is sunsetting the right to rent for short terms. So initially the move was, if you already had a license under the prior regime, you can keep it. But anyone who is not an owner-occupant can no longer or can't get a license past a certain date. And so there was the issue of whether you're an owner-occupant, and in my case, the Andings were not. But they were sunsetting really all short-term rentals. And the issues in the case had to do with the city saying, here are the harms from short-term rentals. So even if we allow some, such as owner-occupied, that's type one, then the harms still justify not allowing people from other places or non-owner occupants to rent from renting for short terms. So the case didn't turn on the issue of owner occupancy. It turned on the issue of what are the harms. And as we know, the city there had absolutely no proof of any harms. Finally, I want to talk about another recent case which illustrates the gravity of the property interest. And this was a case that my clients filed against the City of Waxahachie. We had a preliminary injunction hearing where the judge pulled the lawyers aside and described how her husband had recently been at a short-term rental and had the police called on him when he was sitting on the back porch. What I've done with these three examples of actual cases that I've litigated is shown that short-term rentals, number one, are important to people, and number two, that they can't find peace when they're in them, because we basically now have a sort of East German surveillance state where your neighbors can turn you in because they don't know who you are. And the police show up when you're a renter. And as in this case, as Fort Worth has described, and I can talk about what's in the record here, start, quote, talking to the tenants, which is really, if you're a tenant, I think amounts to an interrogation. Now I want to talk about how the liberty interest arises in the first place. One of the surprising things about this case to me is that it upends a lot of what I was taught in graduate school about how everything is relative and there's no such thing as natural rights. Well, really, the jurisprudence increasingly in our country and especially in our state focuses a lot on this idea, as the court talked about in this in the Grapevine case in 2021, of natural rights. And this language is all over Texas jurisprudence. We have it in Spann in 1921, in a very recent case, and we have it, of course, in the Grapevine case. We have it in a very recent case from the Texas Supreme Court. This is called State versus Lowe, L-O-E. And Justice Young wrote a concurrence in that case in which he writes, and I'll paraphrase, the reason that some rights are not expressed in the Constitution is that no one ever thought we had to make them express. They are fundamental, they are natural, and they form part of the background of our rights. In this case, we have two kinds of rights at stake. One is for the retroactivity claim, and since we have seven clients who have that, I'll get to that second. But the first is the fundamental right to lease. And what this court did in the Grapevine case is go part of the way towards telling us that leasing for short terms is a natural right, but it didn't quite get there.
Well, didn't we leave open the idea that a city could put some guardrails and barriers around that right?
I would put it differently. I would say what you left open is the possibility that trial, evidence, could make a difference. And that's what's so important in this case. When we talk about the settled or fundamental natural right, what Patel, harking back to all the way back to Spann and City of Cleburne, say is that in an as-applied challenge like this, evidence matters. The record matters. My own view of what you wrote in your Grapevine opinion, with all due respect, is that leasing is a fundamental right. And now because all we're talking about now is whether the threshold of issue of whether you've stated a claim is whether now you can marshal your evidence at trial and show that that extends on an as-applied basis to your ability to rent for short terms. And what the evidence that you need to present is, since the city says it causes harms, go show that it doesn't. And we showed that. And we showed it in a couple different ways.
You asked to reserve 5 minutes. Do you still want to reserve 5 minutes?
Yes.
Okay, then your time is up.
Thank you.
Madam Chief Justice, may it please the court. If I may, for just a moment, I want to back up and put the case in some proper context. So the city does not think that short-term rentals and the people who rent them out are some sort of pariah that need to be banished from the cities altogether. Instead, the city's ordinances are designed to put short-term rentals where they already are and where they fit in with the uses of that district. And this wasn't some arbitrary decision. The city spent years researching the issue, years of public outreach. As a part of that process, the city even hired a data mining company, Decker Technology, to tell us where the city's short-term rentals are. And not surprisingly, the vast majority of them are where you think they'd be, the entertainment districts and the stockyards and downtown. So the city passed an ordinance that allows short-term rentals in these commercial and mixed-use districts. But after hearing from citizens and doing its own research, the city decided to continue its policy of prohibiting short-term rentals in single-family residential neighborhoods, Fairmont, Como, Arlington Heights, University West. It's a balancing test, as Justice Kerr, as you noted, there's competing interests involved. But more than that, it's the legislative process working how it's supposed to. So this is the same process that the city of Arlington used when it created the STR zones and restricted them, restricted short-term rentals from very specific places and allowed them nearby to the Cowboys Stadium, the Rangers Stadium, things like that. And it's the zones that this court, of course, upheld in the Draper case, which plaintiffs have never really addressed in their briefing. But the city's, I think, reasoned solution to the new sort of problem that STRs are causing is just apparently not good enough for the plaintiffs, most of whom, by the way, don't live in Fort Worth. They want to operate many hotels in the areas they should be, but they also want to operate them in the single-family residential neighborhoods. And so that's where we are. The city was trying to strike a reasonable balance between competing interests, not abolish some sacrosanct right that plaintiffs claim to have in leasing short-term and residential neighborhoods. Justice Burgess, the trial court judge in this case, properly framed the issue. Does the city have the authority to do what it did? And because the answer is undeniably yes, we ask the court to affirm. So the time I have today, I want to talk about three primary things. First, I want to get into the rational basis analysis because I think, Justice Kerr, to your point, it does absolutely apply. Second, I'm going to get a little bit into the second prong of Patel, which is the unduly burdensome prong. And then third, I'm going to get into the plaintiff's retroactivity claim because it has a little bit of different analysis, even though a lot of the evidence for all the different claims sort of overlaps. So with rational basis, the first thing I'm going to talk about, and the reason I'm going to talk about it is because that same analysis applies to plaintiff's due course of law and equal protection claim. That is, and again, they have the burden, not the city, contrary to what my esteemed colleague represented. They have the burden to show that the ordinances that we passed are not rationally related to legitimate government purposes. And as this court wrote in the Draper case, this is a deferential test, and it asks, quote, whether it is fairly debatable that the ordinances are rationally related to a legitimate government objective. The court is not concerned with whether the ordinance is effective, but only if the city could rationally have believed at the time of enactment that the ordinance would promote its objective. And again, that's the Draper case. And just to give you some idea of how this is played out, to date, not one single appellate court, Texas appellate court, has struck down a short-term ordinance as violating the rational basis test. In fact, the opposite is true. We have the Draper case from this court. From around the country, you have the Nekrolov case that's cited in our brief. It's from the Third Circuit, upholding an STR regulation in the face of due process, federal due process, and equal protection challenges. You have the Villanueva case, and this is actually not cited in our brief because it issued not long before we filed. It's 2025 Westlaw 2946607. It's a summary judgment case, granting summary judgment on due course of law and equal protection claims. You have the Marfil case out of the Western District of Texas, and that's cited in our brief, also granting summary judgment on due process and equal protection claims. And all of these courts applied the rational basis test to short-term rental ordinances and said, you know what, that they pass muster. So the first question in the rational basis test is, what's the purpose of the ordinance? Now, we've identified several, three in our briefing that you can glean out. Preserving the residential character of neighborhoods, preserving the health and safety of the general public, and then preserving the long-term housing market. Now, we briefed all three, and any one of them, as the court noted in the Draper case, are legitimate purposes that support a short-term rental ordinance, but I'm going to focus a little bit on the residential character idea. So again, multiple courts, including this court in the Draper case, have held that preserving the residential character of a single family neighborhood is a legitimate purpose that can justify a short-term rental regulation. Again, I'm going to quote this court, who is actually quoting a California court from the Draper case. It said, it stands to reason that the residential character of a neighborhood is threatened when a significant number of homes are occupied not by permanent residents, but by a stream of tenants staying a weekend, a week, or even 29 days. The recent case from the New Braunfels short-term rental ordinance, the Marfil case, the court rejected a due course of law challenge or due process challenge based on preserving residential character alone. The court said this, this court can clearly understand how short-term renters could affect the residential character within neighborhoods, specifically those which are zoned for single or dual family living. And the court held, therefore, this court finds that there exists a rational basis for this ordinance, at least for the preservation of residential character. And that's the Marfil case, 2025 Westlaw 243028, and that's cited in our brief. And what we have here is we do have evidence in the record, contrary to what my colleague would lead you to believe, there's plenty of evidence in the record that shows that short-term rentals not only cause nuisance-like harms to neighborhoods, they also erode the residential character of neighborhoods. The Assistant City Manager, Dana Bergdoff, her affidavit is in the record, and I urge you to read it. She has she's an expert in city planning. She stated in her affidavit that short-term rentals are out of place in neighborhoods where people know each other, or at least have the chance to. We've got Peter Tarlow's affidavit in the record. He's at 2CR 1160. He testified to the same. And even you have some plaintiffs in this case admitting that STRs can negatively impact neighborhoods. Ed Amaya, in his deposition, acknowledged that an STR tenant has a different, quote, psychology than long-term residents because an STR tenant is not, quote, invested in the city. They don't live here. Susan Harper, another plaintiff, acknowledged that an STR is incompatible, this is a quote, incompatible with the fundamental characteristics of a residential neighborhood and is not the same thing as a family living in that property and being engaged in the community. That's at CR 204. Harper went on, Harper apparently was in the real estate business, to state that statistically, if any more than 40% of a neighborhood is a rental, that neighborhood is in decline. That's at CR 203. And this isn't surprising. Common sense compels this conclusion. You know, even if a one-night stay could be considered some sort of residential use of the property, no one could rationally believe or contend that such a use is the same character as a 20-year stay or a 2-year stay. As anyone who lived in a home for multiple years knows, the longer you live there, the more you get to know your neighbors, the more your lives become intertwined, as opposed to staying for a weekend and never knowing exactly who somebody is. So in their reply brief, the main point that the plaintiffs get at is they say, well, the city can't restrict SDRs in residential neighborhoods because it's just a residential use of property. Now, we disagree with that characterization. The plaintiffs admitted in their deposition that there's a commercial aspect to it because obviously they're renting it out to make money. The Villanueva court characterized STRs as a quasi-residential use of property because there's residential uses happening, sleeping, eating, and things of that nature, but there's also a commercial aspect to it. But let's credit their theory that this is a residential use of property. That does not mean the city can't regulate it. Obviously, hotels, apartment complexes, residential uses happen in those all the time, but there nobody disputes that the city can prohibit apartments and hotels from being in residential districts. So this idea that the residential use of the tenants, the sleeping and the eating, prohibits the city from ever doing anything to combat the negative impacts they have is just not true.
Well, I would imagine that the other side would say perhaps that, you know, hotels and things like that are different because they're, you know, owned by corporations typically, and that you've got a personal liberty interest when you own your own home with what you decide to do with it as part of your ability to lease it out as a matter of right.
Your Honor, first of all, I think there's a lot of corporations who own these short-term rentals, and that's part of the problem with the housing market issue. But I'd also say that, we're not restricting the right to lease your property at all. Of course, you can still lease it long-term. You can sell it. You can lease it short-term if you have it in a commercial or mixed-use district. But what we are saying is that the duration of the lease term makes a difference. It has a negative impact, not just nuisance-like behavior, but also on the fabric of the community. So their liberty interest, to the extent they even have one, and again, we disagree with that, it does have to have some restrictions to it. As the Supreme Court said, Texas Supreme Court said in the Crown Distribution case that's cited in our briefs, property rights are not absolute. They are subject to restrictions. And that's what we're trying to do here, is protect our citizens against the harms. And again, there's evidence in the record. There's complaints in the record. If you look at Shannon Elder's affidavit, attached to her affidavit, it's in, it is in 2 CR 1009 through 1150. She attached to her affidavit, she's the deputy director of compliance for the city. She attached to her affidavit 100 pages of complaints that said that the citizens made about short-term rentals in their neighborhoods. So in the end, the plaintiff's approach to this problem would universally authorize short-term rentals in every house, in every residential district, in every city in the country, but that's not the law. So that's summing up my rational basis analysis. Again, that applies to equal protection and to due course of law. And so it can be affirmed on residential character, which I just discussed. It can be affirmed on nuisance-like property behaviors, and it can be affirmed on depletion of the long-term housing market. And we've got evidence that's cited in our brief that supports the idea that these are all legitimate purposes, and they are all being served by the short-term rental ordinances. And now briefly, I'm going to turn just to the Patel, the second prong of Patel, because what the Supreme Court said in Patel is someone who's challenging an economic regulation. This is not necessarily, I don't know that it's ever been applied to a zoning regulation, except for one case where the court struck down a challenge under Patel. A person challenging an economic regulation can show that it either is not rationally related to a legitimate purpose, or that it is so burdensome as to be oppressive in light of the government interests involved. And what I'll tell you, first of all, is that there is a recent federal district case out of Texas that addressed Patel to a Patel challenge, the second prong, and that's the Villanueva case. Again, that's not cited in our brief because it issued probably a week before we filed. And so I'll take responsibility that I was unaware of it, but that was 2025 Westlaw 2946607. And it specifically addressed a second Patel prong challenge to a short-term rental organization. But that Patel, but going back to just the Patel test, Justice Young said it best in his concurrence in Crown Distribution and saying that their economic regulation at issue in that case didn't violate Patel, was that if an economic regulation has, quote, left room for a person to participate in an affected industry, then it passes Patel. So here what we've got, we have evidence that plaintiffs obviously can still live at their properties, they can rent them long-term, they can rent them short-term in commercial and mixed-use districts, or they can sell their properties. But the fact that they can no longer participate in some vague so-called residential district STR market doesn't render the ordinance as unduly burdensome under Patel. And the minimal burden that the ordinance is placed on the plaintiffs is made even more measured when it's contrasted with the city's legitimate interests in supporting thriving residential neighborhoods and preserving affordable housing prices for local residents. There's nothing inherently oppressive, at least in my mind, about requiring home rentals in residential neighborhoods to be made to tenants whose uses comport more closely to long-term permanent residents. And again, I'll point you to the Villanueva case that specifically addressed a Patel second prong challenge. And briefly, with the time I have left, I'm just going to focus a little bit on the retroactivity. It has a little bit of a different analysis. And I'm sorry, I'm gonna back up just for a second when it comes to equal protection and due course of law. Plaintiffs in their argument focused on the idea they have a vested interest in leasing short-term and residential neighborhoods. Of course, we disagree with that, and we've briefed that issue extensively to the court. I'm not gonna focus too much time on it today because I will tell you, even if the court were to conclude that such an interest existed, they still have to show that the ordinances are not rationally related to legitimate interests and are unduly burdensome, which they can't do. But I will just point to you our briefing on the vested interest piece. We don't think that they have a vested interest to lease short-term in residential districts. So as to retroactivity, again, this claim has a little bit of different analysis, but most of the evidence that supports the ordinance, the evidence of harms that the short-term rentals cause, is relevant to the retroactivity claim, and that's because part of the claim is analyzing what the city's public compelling interest is in passing the ordinances. So for a retroactivity claim, and the Robinson case, of course, is the premier case, the court considers the nature of the claimed interest, the extent of the law's impairment on that interest, and then whether the city has a compelling public interest in enacting the law. And so what we've got here is we have seven of the plaintiffs, of the hundreds of plaintiffs below, who have claimed they have a settled expectation in leasing short-term rental, leasing their homes for short-term periods, excuse me.
Had any of those seven been doing that before 2018?
So the only evidence that they cited in their brief was that two of them in their affidavits said that they were, and that's Lauren Brady and Smith. I think his name is Terry Smith, I forget, but that's the only evidence they presented. And it's just statements in their affidavit that they were operating short-term rentals pre-2018. But assuming that's even true, the city has always prohibited STRs in residential neighborhoods as more like bed and breakfast inns and breakfast homes, which are not authorized uses in residential districts. But let's just say that, STRs don't neatly fit into this B&B restriction, because we'll acknowledge that the short-term rental is sort of a novel issue, so we're putting it somewhere that we thought it belonged, but maybe it doesn't fit neatly into that description. But the city has never actually permitted short-term rentals in residential districts, never. And that's what makes this case different from Zatari. City of Austin gave the residents the ability to lease short-term, and then they took it away. And that's the problem the Austin Court of Appeals had. But we've never had that here. We've always had the policy coming from the top down that short-term rentals are not permitted use in residential districts. But even setting that aside, there's no dispute they've never been allowed. in essence, you know, if you want to put it in a way, there's been a vacuum of any kind.
Don't you presume it's allowed until it's prohibited? I mean, don't you have it backwards? You said we've never permitted it. Well, the permission is there until it's restricted.
Your Honor, I don't know that silence on an issue necessarily, but what I'm not disagreeing with you to some extent, but I don't know that silence on an issue like this would give you a settled expectation. Whether or not you can do it without getting in trouble is a different aspect of whether then you get a settled expectation that you have the right to continue to do it once the city says it's not okay.
Is there anything in the record? I don't think there is, but that says that they were operating them and the city was shutting them down? Years ago when there was no
one. There's one instance in the record, I think it's from, and I'm sorry, it's in 2013 or 14, where there was an agreed injunction against a short-term rental operating in a residential neighborhood. It is in the record, and I apologize, I don't have the record site for that, but there is some of that in the record.
Okay.
So again, it's if there's a dearth of authority, I think, you know, you could do it without getting in trouble, but then it doesn't give you a settled expectation under a retroactivity claim to say that the ordinance at issue has violated the Constitution. I think that's a whole other thing. And beyond that, even assuming that the plaintiffs could, or the two that produced evidence that they were operating pre-2018 had some sort of settled expectation, a compelling public interest overcomes that. As the Supreme Court said in the AV case, a valid exercise of the police power by the legislature to safeguard the public safety and welfare is a recognized exception to the unconstitutionality of retroactive laws. The Kilpatrick case from this court said the constitutional rules against retroactive laws are not absolute and must yield to a state's right to safeguard the public safety and welfare. And again, the Villanueva case recently rejected a retroactivity claim on the short-term regulation before it. So with that, Your Honor, I'll conclude, but we ask the court to affirm because this was a proper exercise of the city's zoning authority.
Thank you.
Thank you.
The fundamental problem with the city's whole presentation is the deep ideological question. The city wants to dictate people's movements, private comings and goings, in residential districts. And that gets to the question of whether or not this is commercial. These districts in which my clients own homes have always been zoned residential. Therefore, all residential uses have been allowed. Hotels are not allowed. Hotels are a commercial use. Hotels are owned and controlled by whoever operates the hotel and has a concierge and a front desk. All of that is settled law under Tarr and Jay Bryce in the Supreme Court, and even in this court's Grapevine decision in Garrett versus Simpson, which was a deed restriction case.
Well, let me ask you about Draper. I mean, are we going to have to reverse ourselves in Draper to find in your favor here?
I will tell you that we do disagree with part of your opinion in Draper, but you don't have to get there. You don't have to create a conflict because Draper didn't address the second part of Patel. That challenge was never brought. And so if you decide this case under that second prong, then you sidestep any issues about inconsistency in your jurisprudence. That said, Justice Kerr, you did write about residential character. And I will say I disagree with you. Renting for short term, so long as people do what people ordinarily do in homes, just as the Supreme Court said in Tarr, is necessarily residential. And that applies both to owners of second homes, that is someone who may have a part-time home in Fort Worth that they only visit for short terms, or tenants. And so when the city says it wants to strike a balance, what it's saying is we want to control what happens in private homes. And that is simply not how it works in our country. I want to mention the Nekrolov case out of the Third Circuit. That was a substantive due process case, but where the plaintiffs never actually argued the meat of substantive due process. All they argued was that the mayor had exerted undue influence. Nekrolov came up a lot in the Marfil oral argument in the Fifth Circuit, and we tried to swat it away on the same basis. There is no other decision in this country that can, that is like this case or the pending Dickinson case or the upcoming Grapevine case. Texas is leading the jurisprudence in this area. We have many different cases coming up. So the issue how to reconcile Draper is the second prong of Patel. I wish we didn't have to keep fighting the issue of whether living in a home for a short term is residential. In the Villanueva case referenced by my friend across the aisle, the federal district court created an all-new category, unprecedented in any decision, of quasi-residential. And what the judge said there, I think, is telling. Well, it's commercial partly because landlords are making money. Well, that's just leasing. And second, people are coming and going. Well, yes, they are. As in my hypothetical, people come and go from homes, and they do so for all kinds of reasons, and it's not open for the government to inspect that. I want to point to some evidence in the record here.
They're not really doing it, inspecting the reasons. They're regulating the duration.
As a practical matter, what happens when the police or the code department shows up is they start quizzing people about where they came from. That's why we have some of these ordinances which actually say only permanent residents can live in a house here, which is a violation of the Dormant Commerce Clause. That is, in the process of quizzing people how long they're there, other questions arise. And I will say to you that the danger is that is what is always going to happen when what we create, what we do is render illegitimate the mere status of how long you're staying in a house. There was a point made that one of my clients said that if 40% of the homes in a district become rental homes, then property values fall and people don't want to live there. Well, that may well be true. And that is why, under the city's arguments, it can now ban all leasing. And that's where this is going. I have a case pending in the Texas Supreme Court right now at the petition stage where a subdivision has banned all leasing, and that movement is accelerating. If there are no more questions, I see I'm out of time.
Thank you very much. Gentlemen, we do appreciate your arguments today. They have been helpful. Your case is now submitted, and you're free to go. Thank you.
All rise. The Honorable Court of Appeals for the Second District of Texas now stands adjourned.